This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on February 25, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open session for Thursday, February 25th, 2010 will now come to order. First item on the agenda is the approval of minutes for January 29th, 2010. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of agenda document 1009, the minutes of our meeting from January 29th, 2010.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. The next item on the agenda is AO 2010-01, submitted by the Nevada State Democratic Party. Commissioner Walther is recusing from this matter. Let the record reflect that Commissioner Walther has left the room. Vice Chair, we have late submitted documents.
Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document number 10-11 and 10-11A.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 5-0. We have Mark Elias with us today on behalf of the Nevada State Democratic Party to answer any questions that the commissioners may have, and feel free to take a place at the witness table. We have a presentation by General Counsel David Atkins and Amy Rothstein on this matter, and feel free to proceed when ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, commissioners. Agenda documents 10-11, the draft, and 10-11A, the alternative draft, respond to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of the Nevada State Democratic Party. The state party asks whether a contribution or expenditure would result from its purchase of campaign materials that are distributed by volunteers on behalf of the state party's preferred candidates before the primary election. The first draft concludes that no contribution or expenditure would result if the materials are distributed on behalf of candidates after they have become the party's nominees, both as a matter of fact and as a matter of state law. The alternative draft reaches the same conclusion and also concludes that the cost would be exempt if the materials were distributed on behalf of the state party's preferred nominees as determined by party rules and bylaws. The commission received one comment on the draft, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Are there any comments or questions for the witness or amongst ourselves? Commissioner McGinn.
I guess I'll take the lead since... So the public knows the holdup, I think, was because of me, because I'm grappling with this one. And I have some questions for Mr. Elias. I think they could help my thinking. But before asking questions, I want to try to explain where I am and what my thought process is. The question before us concerns volunteer mail, as it's known in the trade, exempt party functions, as it's known at the Federal Election Commission. This was something put in by Congress in the late 70s. After FECA had become the law, apparently a lot of the yard signs, bumper stickers, and the more grassroots material disappeared because everyone was afraid that would count against the coordinated spending limit. So they put this in to bring back the things that the politicians like. Over the years, the commission has snaked around back and forth as to what it means to do volunteer materials, but really the consistent theme has been more permissive than the council's office was recommending at the time, regardless of who the council was, because if you go back to the legislative history and the actual language and really the time of 1979, what the world looked like in 79 is not what the world looked like today with technology and how you move message and how you do the mechanics of a party operation. So the problems I'm having is the statute was drafted in one era, and now we are in another era, and there's been a lot of water under that bridge between then and now. So there's really two issues I want to discuss. One is squarely raised by the AO. The second, I think, is germane, although not squarely raised, and it's more of a talk about maybe what the future looks like. If you go back to the statute and look to the legislative history, The House Admin Report makes clear that for exempt party functions, the so-called volunteer mail, it's for quote, those who have been nominated, unquote, by their party, which would seem to mean the primary has come and gone. This is a distinction that I think the commission maintained for quite a while. If you look at advisory opinion 8415, which is the one the RNC asked for, was really more about ads. There is language in 8415 that distinguishes between coordinated expenditures and volunteer mail, and the commission maintained the distinction because in volunteer mail, it is on behalf of the nominee, but in coordinated, it is in connection with the general election. So they read that as a statutory distinction. Along comes a MER in 1998, and that distinction was conflated, and in a 6-0 vote, the commission really abandoned that distinction and started reading the volunteer materials exemption and the coordinated expenditure provisions more alike. Part of why I think the draft that went public didn't discuss the coordinated thing was for that reason. I saw it as a retreat back to maybe more the 1984 thing. So that's why I think that came out. So you have the legislative history that talks about nomination, but this is not nomination because the question here is, can the state party do volunteer mail before the primary actually happens? The commission has already said yes in a MER. I think that becomes the new legal norm. I don't think we can go back to square one. So I think the 98 MER is the rule, and it's not that MERs make rules, but it's once the tide goes down, so to speak, that becomes the new high water mark for how much we can regulate. And that's what happened in that MER, in my view. But there is still language from 8415 that I think survives. And that language says the act refers to expenditures, quote, in connection with the general election campaign, which, of course, is talking about coordinated. But since that's been conflated in the 98 MER, maybe this applies to volunteer mail. And it says, where a candidate appears assured of a party's presidential nomination, the general election campaign, or at least from the political party's perspective, it may begin prior to the formal nomination. So that seems to not necessarily be a mechanical ballot access rule, but from the party's perspective. So that got me thinking. I was already reading this when your comments came in, and I thought really the draft that went out seemed like a pretty good result in that it resulted in a rather bright line. Once the petition process, ballot access process, whatever you want to call it, closes, you know there's not going to be opposition, so the person is the presumptive nominee. But you go back to 8415, and maybe this draft, that the first draft that came out, is a reversal of 8415. I don't know. That's why the second draft is out there referring more to party rules. So the first question I have is, help me with this. That's where I am. Explain to me why, in your comments, you don't like the first draft, and what do you think of the second draft?
Well, let me start with by paraphrasing something that former Commissioner and Chairman Michael Toner was fond of saying. We're talking about hard money. Let's take a step back for a second, because there's a lot going on in the news right now about corporate money and corporate expenditures and independent expenditures. We are talking about the abilities of state parties to use hard money to fund volunteer distribution of campaign materials. Okay, so we're talking about something that, frankly, as a policy matter, and I know that's not directly your question, I'm going to answer your question, but as a policy matter, we're talking about the kinds of activity that everybody on the left, on the right, in the center says is what we ought to be promoting, which is volunteers using hard money to distribute materials on behalf of party-supported candidates.
And this just isn't you saying this. This is Congress saying it in the late 70s. And if you read legislative and more legislative history, It makes clear that the parties are to be given flexibility. Congressman Frenzel, I think, it was the one who has this statement, and it's been cited in commission folklore over the years. So I think it's not only hard money, but Congress never put any sort of minimums on the volunteer activity. And this is the sort of thing designed to get volunteers involved. Legislative history couldn't be clearer, right?
Correct.
Moreover, to bring up our old friend Citizens United, it's not that old, but, well, it's been talked about a lot. Big push on what are we going to do about it? Well, if we agree, and probably in our personal politics we don't agree on much, but maybe on this we do, if the candidate's voice is supposed to be the central voice in American politics, what's the best way to do that? right? Outside groups is not the best way to have the candidate's voice be the central voice. Perhaps the party's echoing that voice. So not only is this hard money, this is something that can be coordinated with the campaign, which allows it to be much more politically accountable than independent expenditures. Not to cut off kind of what you're going to go down the road, but my sense is your client can do this mail regardless. This is not about more money or less money in the system. It's whether it's going to be an independent expenditure. You may have already printed mail. Maybe this particular mail you're thinking about can't be an IE, but it can be an independent expenditure, which again is hard money. It can be a coordinated expenditure, but then that's less money that can go into other direct voter communication, or it can be volunteer mail. So we're talking about direct voter communication, all hard money, coordinated potentially with a candidate. So as a policy matter, that seems to be something Congress is in favor of. Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with it. And in fact, if the party does it as coordinated or independent expenditures, then the only people who lose out are the volunteers, right? So all that the commission will have done is to disincentivize the parties bringing more volunteers into the process and funding their materials that they are involved in the distribution of.
Let me ask you a question on that point. Your AO represents that your volunteer component is going to be sufficient. Mm-hmm. Are you sure about that?
Well, there's a larger question about the commission's clarity around what the volunteer component necessary is. For purposes of this advisory opinion, we chose not to open that box. The commission has in recent years, I will say, done, I think, a very good job of taking sensible approaches to some of the complaints that emerge that it has resolved, to try to take the pressure off of parties in allowing them to involve volunteers in ways that make sense given the technology of today. And it is a different technology than it was in 1979. And what that has the effect of doing is strengthening state parties, strengthening hard money within state parties. And those are goals, as you point out, that it is not just Congress in 1979 or Congress in 1974, but it's Congress today, and the American people today have supported. And again, on all sides of the aisle, whatever you think of Citizens United, whether you think it was right or wrong, everyone agrees that part of the solution to good, healthy politics is stronger hard money politics and stronger parties. And you know, I think that the commission has in recent years, you're right, has taken a more permissive approach towards volunteer exempt activities precisely because of that policy rationale. And I think it's well within your discretion to continue to do that. There is nothing that requires the commission to adopt the first draft. There's frankly nothing that requires even the mechanical application of internal party rules that is reflected in the second draft. My own view is that if it's what the party wants to do, then frankly, there's no reason for a murr to be generated over whether or not the party rules or bylaws or were the party bylaws followed about how they did. I mean, it seems to me that the party does it. The commission should presume the party had the authority within their own rules to do so.
I hear you, but that's where I get hung up, because then the statute kind of pops up, and the exempt party functions are exempt for the party's nominee. So it seems to me an exemption from the general election contribution limit.
Right.
Right. So if we're going to keep moving the date back to when the party thinks, does that mean the nominee, your presumptive nominee, would have to stop raising primary money as of March 12th? Does the contribution limit then float back? Because it's a contribution limit issue as well. Even though it's hard money, we can't just avoid it and say, well, the party can kind of do what they want. Because unlike coordinated, once you blow coordinated, it's gone. And if the party guesses wrong. But the volunteer activities can roll the whole time.
Yeah, although
the flip side, though, is it's also clear you can do volunteer activity for state and local candidates.
Right.
So you may want to mention a federal candidate to help the state and local, but then what if that guy turns out he withdraws? That just happened in Indiana, right? That was a presumptive nominee. Maybe you could have done volunteer activity, and all of a sudden your nominee leaves. And this is something that I'm really having trouble with. I like the idea of in this case, March 12th, which is the ballot access, because at least that's a rule. It seems consistent with the prior MER. I don't see us retreating from that MER in any way, shape, or form. But when I read your comments, I said, wait a second, maybe we are. But it can't just be when the party thinks it's the nominee. There has to be some standard. Otherwise, everybody's going to be in Merland for years, and it's going to feel like the Winter Olympics figure skating judges, where we're just going to decide after the fact who is right and who is wrong. We need a rule.
I would actually argue that the way to avoid Merland, which, believe me, No one wants to avoid more than I do. The way to avoid it is not to, the fact is the party does have some skin in the game that they lose, which is the money they spent. So it may not be a limit like 441 AD if they guess wrong, but they have spent money on a candidate that winds up not prevailing. That's a real incentive on state parties to make sure they are choosing correctly. It's called hard money for a reason. It's hard to raise. And for state parties, it's particularly hard to come by. And especially with the restrictions on transfer down, even in the post-Alaska Democratic Party merger, there are still significant restrictions here that disincentivize parties just sort of willy-nilly going off and spending this money. So I think there is something that the state parties are giving up if they do exempt activities and are wrong. I guess my bottom line on this is that there came a point in the election cycle, to use the presidential elections for a moment, which I realize is a little bit of apples and oranges, where the Republican Party could confidently say John McCain was our nominee. Now, could he have withdrawn? Yeah, he could have. He could have decided not to go to Minneapolis. Could the delegates have staged an uprising? Yeah, they could have. Could another candidate put his or her name into nomination? Absolutely, and in fact, that happens. But it can't be that because a fringe candidate decides that they will pay a $100 fee, or in some states not even $100, and put their name on the ballot in the primary, that somehow a party doesn't know or can't know who its nominee is. I mean, sometimes it is simply self-evident to the party that this is our nominee, for good, for bad, for better or worse, this is our nominee, and their associational First Amendment rights to advocate on that nominee using hard money and volunteers seems to me at the low end of difficult calls for a commission whose job is to regulate politics. I mean, we're not talking about soft money, we're not talking about 1984-15 or 1985-14, which were the start of the issue ad mergers. We're talking about something that is at the core of what everyone, like I said, is right about politics, which is parties saying, these are the candidates we think are our candidates, and we want to use hard money and volunteers to get out the word about them and not wait till the primary.
I couldn't agree with you more. Certainly, the Supreme Court's decision in Jones couldn't be clearer. Associational rights of parties is an argument I make a lot here. But you still have the statute. Mm-hmm. And you still have a lot of other states other than Nevada, for example, in Texas. We can talk all about this, the party's nominee, all we want, but in Texas, Democrats can vote in the Republican primary and vice versa. So is it really the party's nominee when one team can vote in the other team's, primary? Virginia, right. You don't have partisan registration at all. It always amuses me whenever we list party affiliation of commissioners. Two of us are in Virginia, so actually two of us don't have party affiliation.
Right. But it's in some ways it's actually more important for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact is,
we have a rule though that sort of is a federal rule that everybody can
you
follow?
You let the party if the Vermont Democratic Party decided that Senator Sanders is their nominee, even though he ran on an independent line. He's their nominee. He is the candidate that they hold up as their standard bearer. Why should the Federal Election Commission say, no, you have to understand.
The Federal Election Commission, Mark. It's a statute.
Well, but the commission has the statutory authority and the right to interpret the statute and to apply the statute. And I think I have not heard anyone, and I have not read anything or heard any commentary, or there's nothing in the drafts that suggests that this is a question where the commission is unable to take that view, unable to take a more permissive view of the law. In every step it has not been subject to challenge.
Let's play out the logic of your position. And since you invoked the presidential, let's stay on the presidential, and we'll just talk in the hypothetical. Because in the last presidential election, there was no incumbent. Term limits being what they are, everyone was on equal footing, so to speak, right? There was no presumptive, right? But generally there is. So hypothetically, let's say there's a president who's not term limited, who is seeking re-election. Under your logic, if a state party decided that president is their candidate of choice, they could start doing volunteer mail today for the next presidential election. The day after the next presidential election, in this hypothetical, let's say it's a first term, the day after that person gets elected, you can do volunteer mail for 4 years. That can't be the rule. Because although generally you think that the president is going to be the nominee, 68, that didn't quite work out that way. 76 almost didn't work out that way. And 80 almost didn't work out that way. And certain state parties really weren't on board with their what other state parties said was the presumptive nominee. So leaving it to the parties, believe me, if I could, I would. But I'm not sure that's a rule either.
Right. Well, the facts that you raise, point out first, aren't before you in a number of important respects. And I don't mean that just in the that it's not a presidential campaign. In your hypothetical, the president, that hypothetical president, presumably hasn't filed a statement of candidacy, has taken no affirmative steps, not only not to be a candidate under FEC law, hasn't taken any steps to be a candidate under state law either, hasn't, the point of opening the petitions hasn't even begun yet, no less the closing of the qualification process. So I'm not.
But see, now you're using the qualification process.
Well, no. To the question is whether or not they're even a candidate. Mm-hmm. In other words, whether or not forget about whether they're a nominee. They're, at that point, they haven't announced that they're even a candidate for future elections. So, I mean, that raises a whole other set of questions of the ability of the commission to regulate promotion of people who, in fact, aren't candidates. But assuming for a moment that the commission takes a position, it can regulate those activities. You know, it is a far cry from the situation where you are in an election year. You know, you know, if you had, let's say you had a House candidate running in New York, the primary is not until September.
Right.
So that person doesn't get volunteer exempt activity until potentially mid to late September. And if one person's on the ballot against them, no matter how low the polls are, no matter the fact that no one knows that they're even running in a competitive primary, then you wind up in this odd situation that person is deprived exempt activity. I mean, it's a little bit like
it's even trickier in New York because you don't just have two lines. You've got Liberal right. Party, Conservative right. Party, and whatever right. other party shows
I mean,
up.
I,
everybody's vying for every party line, so you never really know who's who until September.
I say this with all due respect, since I have a chair who is formerly from the Senate Rules Committee and a commissioner formerly from the House Ethics Committee, but it is a little bit like the blackout periods that take place in the Senate, which candidly are extreme. I mean, people are blacked out because there is any possibility that they may not be, that they will have a competitive election. And I think that this commission around exempt activities, and that's not to criticize, by the way, the Senate or the House, but this commission has taken a much more pragmatic and functional view around exempt activities in the last decade or two. And I think it would be a shame to stop that now. I would urge the commission to continue that trend of taking a pretty functional view of whether or not.
But the functional view has been in the mechanics of doing the mail. How much volunteer component is enough volunteer component?
Well, the Baucus MER, the Montana MER that you referred to, did deal with the question of pre-nomination.
But the facts of that MER were still he was the only act in town.
Yes, but
we don't know in this case that this is going to be the only act in town until the filing closes, right? Now, you may have cleared – politically, you may tell me you know the field is cleared and all that, but, you know, there's other states where there's primary contenders. You know, in the neighboring states, Utah and Arizona, the incumbent senators are being challenged in primaries.
And those parties are going to come under – those parties, as a practical matter, are going to not be able to do exempt activities because they have competitive primaries and because the chair of the party is going to be neutral – is going to proclaim neutrality for that reason. But, you know, but if
– you don't know that.
Well, you don't. But if you had to err on the side of more speech by volunteers using hard money or less, right, you can paint some outlier circumstances just as I am. And if the commission views the need to establish either the tie is going to go to the speaker or the tie is going to go to the federal government regulating the speaker, I'd urge you to say, well, all right, you're right. There may be those one-off situations where the Utah Democratic Party chair is going to decide that, you know what, we're going to play in what's truly a competitive primary. Unlikely, your experience with state party chairs is probably pretty similar to mine. That's not a role they view themselves in competitive primaries. On the other hand, the fact that a fringe candidate in some of these states that do not have stringent ballot access rules is simply on the ballot. I mean, even in the presidential debate circumstance, this commission has acknowledged that there are some thresholds where you can say that someone doesn't actually qualify, even though they're technically on the ballot. And maybe, you know, I realize I'm not here to negotiate with you the content of your drafts, but, you know, how about they didn't poll over 10% in any public poll. I mean, there has to be something by which they don't qualify just because they got on the ballot. Otherwise, frankly, Democrats could, you know, collude to put a Republican
on the
ballot.
That's what's going to happen.
Collude to put a Democrat. I mean,
you're going to have a token person file just to preclude the exempt party functions and kind of, you know, compromise the ability of parties to do what they want to do. But I still come back to what the rule ought to be, because I can certainly see that situation where a token filer comes in and all of a sudden undoes the presumptive nominee thing. But you don't have that here. And what's the downside here in this case of saying
filing date hasn't closed?
Right. Well, right. Hopefully we didn't give anybody any ideas. What's the downside of the March 12th date here? It's really 2 or 3 weeks, and you could have characterized speech by volunteers. It's really speech by the party, right? It's volunteers being involved in the party. The party's still going to be able to do the mail. It's just a question of, is it independent or coordinated, and whether it's subject to a limit or not.
I mean, I say this in seriousness. There is and this is not aimed, Commissioner McGann, at you. You have been a champion of free speech rights.
But
it is far too often that the commission has sat and said, well, what's another couple of weeks without speech? Right? Why do you need to run ads during this period or that period? Why can't you just wait to do your mail until, you know, March? In New York until September.
And that raises another concern I have. We've had discussions, and I think hopefully the next open meeting we're going to talk about this more, but it's the mechanics of the volunteer component, because if you read the MERS, it seems like there's some consistent themes, but there is some inconsistency. And my view is we probably ought to do some sort of policy statement laying it out so everybody's doing it the same, because otherwise you're going to advise one client to do one thing, perhaps not to name names, but it's the only way to do it. Perhaps, you know, Joe or Neil will advise one of their clients. And then on the other side, the Republicans may do it a different way. You may have a state party doing it one way, a local party doing it another way. I think the commission needs to sort of memorialize the MERS.
I agree.
In some form. I don't think we can retreat from the MERS without a rulemaking. Do you agree with that? I mean,
I do. And the only hesitation I have, I think it would be great for the commission to memorialize and give a clear set of guidelines so that we can give consistent advice across the spectrum to candidates and parties, and that would be welcome. The commission, as I said earlier, should be complimented and applauded for taking a very practical and permissive approach to volunteer involvement with state parties. And that's a good public policy end. It's a good result. It's the right result. On a bipartisan basis, it's the right result for the system, where you're raising hard money into state parties that otherwise need a reason to generate hard money, to operate, to be functioning and vibrant parts of the process. So the commission should be applauded for doing that. I hope that whatever you plan on doing, though, does not become an opportunity to walk back some of those gains that have been achieved through defending MERS, frankly. And, you know, so I would applaud it if it's done constructively and continues on that theme, but I'd hate to do something where
I guess that's because in reality, years ago, volunteers could sort the mail, untack it and all that. Now this is all really being done by machines. You don't really have mailing labels anymore. Technology has allowed for so much more to happen that the volunteers used to do, and now we still have to find a role for the volunteers. And it seems to me, if MERS are turning on hyper-technical things, did the volunteer go to the post office and sign for the mail, or they just load it on the truck? That's not really the sort of thing that contribution limits are designed to police, right? The distinction between the two from a corruption or appearance of corruption standpoint doesn't really seem to be apparent to me.
I agree. From my standpoint, the aim of the statute is achieved by the party bringing volunteers into the process.
Let me ask you this, this could either save us work or cause us work. Do you think a policy statement would help, or do you think the MERS are clear enough?
I think a policy.
Assuming the right policy statement would help. Accurately reflects the MERS.
The right policy statement would help.
Okay.
The wrong policy statement wouldn't.
Well, the wrong policy statement would cause volunteers to not be needed so much anymore.
Correct.
Right? It's just a question of being able to do whatever the party feels like.
No,
it's about volunteer participation.
I represent some national parties. I represent a lot of federal candidates. I represent fewer state parties. What keeps state parties vibrant and actively part of this process is the role they play in recruiting volunteers. And it's not the only thing, obviously. There are other things as well, but it is an important part of the mechanism of the system that helps benefit state parties. And, you know, I think that if you make it too hard, then you're right. Then the people who wind up losing in that are going to be the volunteers, where there'll be fewer things for them to do and less outreach for them and fewer ways to channel their energies, and it will be the state parties.
My final question, it goes back to really what we're here about, which is it March 12th or is it before March 12th? I understand a token nominee, potential nominee could file just to sort of mess up the ability of the party to do things. But when I first approached this case, it seemed to me it's the party's nominee. It's a general election. I would love to have year-round exempt party functions, but that just doesn't seem to be how the law operates. It probably should, but it doesn't. Now, we need some sort of rule, and I'm still hung up on March 12th because when I first read the draft, there were some things I didn't like. I'm not crazy about sort of some of the flow and that kind of thing, but that's stylistic, and at the end of the day, substantively, it's close enough for I think a lot of us to agree on it. But once we go before filing closes, I'm having a lot of trouble grabbing onto something that is solid.
And I come back to, because it is the place where the concept of presumptive nominee has the most force or the most commonality, is, you know, the parties know who their presumptive nominees are in the presidential arena, and they know it long before the ballot is closed and long before there's a theoretical possibility of someone else beating them. And that concept of presumptive
nominee. Sort of, except for 1968 and 1976 and
right?
1980.
But the commission still recognizes that there is a time where there is a presumptive nominee. The Secret Service recognizes that there's a presumptive nominee. The press recognizes that there's a presumptive nominee. The parties recognize there's a presumptive nominee. I mean, it doesn't mean it's perfect. If it were perfect, they'd be the actual nominee, right? But there is a point at which there is a presumptive nominee, and the system functions factually or functionally off of that, you know, works off of that. And if the Texas Republican Party believes that, you know, candidate A is their nominee, and there is, in their judgment, no realistic probability, not theoretical possibility. He could drop out. He could decide not to run. He could, you know, get some great scandal could befall him. But that they have decided that this is the person who we, as an association.
It happens.
Yeah.
It happens.
It does.
Scandals pop up. Primaries happen.
They do. And in that way, for that reason, parties lose 441AD, right? They bet on the wrong horse, even though it's in connection with the general election, which you could argue is actually stricter language than nominee. But the commission has found room there, and appropriately so, and unchallengedly so, and within its discretion. And sometimes parties bet wrong. And likewise, in this instance, there will undoubtedly, if you adopt the rule I suggest, some number of parties will, 10 years from now, be able to look back and find a handful of instances where parties bet wrong. And they will have paid the price. They will have spent hard-earned, hard money on someone who is, in fact, not going to have been their nominee. And that is disincentive enough, I think, for most parties to do it. And I think it is, again, if you have a choice between the tie going to the speaker or the tie going to the government telling them not to speak, I'd rather have a handful of two or three instances where we look back and say, you know what, it's like the 68 presidential election, than have a number of situations where we look back and say, you know, the party couldn't effectively use volunteers to distribute campaign materials for their nominee, you know, until September because there was a late primary. And there was some, you know, some fringe candidate running.
See, in this case, your nominee is going to be your nominee regardless of whether we wait till March 12th or not. And that's what's tough.
But the
and
advisory
it's just an
opinion,
advisory opinion. This is not a rulemaking.
Correct. The
right?
advisory
so in
opinion
this case, it's okay. But then we get into sort of a case-by-case thing, and that gets kind of fuzzy. And how do we grab, for those of us who really don't like the case-by-case thing, and in those of us, I would include the U.S. Supreme Court in that, how do we deal with that?
I think you deal with it by being as reasonable in the case by case as you can be. The places where you
so a permissive case by case is
with all due respect, the cases that have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court or have gone to the higher courts involved, you know, the attempt to not allow a pay-per-view movie to be shown.
Right.
In the case of Emily's List, involved an advisory opinion where the commission said if a federal candidate solicits money for not, out of their own state for use in state races only, they have to pay for the mailer with federal money. So they have involved actually bright lines that have been upon reflection inflexible and ultimately neither made sense nor, in the case of those two instances, constitutional. I think if you take a flexible approach and you give parties the opportunity to identify who their nominees are, I think you face a much lower risk of Merland, as you put it, than you do if you set a flexible, an inflexible test. And that's not to suggest, by the way, that I think that there's going to be a lawsuit over it by any stretch of the imagination. But I think you don't run a real risk of a lot of MERS being generated in that circumstance. I think the reverse is where your greater risk is, that you set a hard test, and at some point the NRCC or the DCCC or the DSCC or the NRC, they talk to a state party and they say, oh, we all know this is your candidate. And no one realizes that some other candidate got on the ballot. No one was paying any attention to it.
And of course, when they move money, they don't say, here's money for mail, right?
No, I'm not even talking about providing money. I'm just saying that the state party, this is a theme, Commissioner, you have been a long champion of. State parties don't hire lawyers, you know, to scrutinize every – they're not the national parties. You know, the Nevada Democratic Party, you know, has a lawyer. That's great. But not every party can afford to have lawyers answering every question as to every fact pattern. And at some point, some national party at the RNC or whatever is going to say,
parties. County parties love to do volunteer activity, and they may want to do some for a federal candidate that's not really even contested in the general.
Right.
And they may have an early, for whatever reason, need to do it for state and local candidates, but they want to have somebody on top of the ticket on the mail piece. And it's frustrating that they can't make sense of any of this either. I hear you on that.
But my point is that what will happen is some state or county party will get it wrong. And they will have gotten it wrong because the law is so complicated. And they didn't know that they had to know whether some other candidate filed on the ballot, and someone in Washington, D.C. didn't realize some other candidate on the ballot had filed, so they'd given them wrong advice. Then the party will get a MER. And then you'll be back here in closed session deciding, all right, what do we do with the Jones County party where there was a token opposition to some House candidate. They had volunteers. All they were trying to do is distribute bumper stickers. Are we really going to tag them for not having 441ED authority assigned to them and not having, you know, and having done exempt and not having the right disclaimer because they used the exempt party disclaimer rather than the. So I think you're going to wind up getting to this place that I'm suggesting you ought to just allow at the front end. Because otherwise, you're setting up some state or local party that's just going to get wrong what the date was or whether there was some token opposition on the ballot.
Thanks for everyone's indulgence.
Further questions and comments? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to focus on the question that you asked and how we answer it consistent with the statute. Because it seems to me that the argument that you're making would make a lot of sense if the statute said that you could use, the parties could use, take advantage of this exception on behalf of candidates of such party, right? Then that would be easy. You know, then we could say, you know, have at it. Pick your candidate, whichever one you like, and you can support that candidate. And believe me, I'm pretty sure I know who the Democratic nominee for Senate from Nevada is going to be, too. And I bet in Las Vegas, you can get pretty long odds on that. So, you know, I don't think that anybody's really confused. Yeah, you know, it's a practical matter. I understand where you're coming from. We all kind of know who the nominee is going to be. But every single cycle, you know this, there are surprises. I mean, a month before the election, I think the presumptive senator from Massachusetts was Martha Coakley. And all of a sudden, now that was an intra-party thing, but still, you know, that was, you know, anytime you got two candidates, one of them can look a lot stronger than the other. There was certainly a time when Charlie Crist was the presumptive nominee from Florida, and, you know, I don't know what the odds are on that race anymore, but, you know, I don't think anybody would say there's one candidate who's got a lock on it. Things happen. Things change. And the statute says it's got to be the nominee. It doesn't say any candidate. So that's what I'm struggling with, that, you know, you say, well, just let us decide. And you use phrases like, well, there might be an ostensible opponent. But who gets to decide that? That ostensible opponent might actually turn out to get a lot of votes. Stephen Colbert might run on a gag, but people might really vote for him if he stayed on the ballot. I mean, comedians have won before. You know, I don't know how to get around that word nominee, and it seems to me the word has to mean something.
Right. Well, I think you raised three issues, so let me unpack them, okay, in order. The first is presumptive nominee, okay? The fact is Attorney General Coakley was never the presumptive senator. I mean, and for that matter, Governor Crist was never the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party in the Senate race. That was a competitive Senate race in Massachusetts in the general election. It was competitive. It was and is a competitive Senate race in Florida. The fact is, this is not a new concept to this commission. When I was the general counsel to the Kerry Edwards campaign, then John Kerry for president, I had conversations with the commission staff who reached out to us because we were the presumptive nominee, right? It wasn't we had won Iowa. It wasn't we were leading in the polls. It was, yes, something could happen. Something could happen that we actually don't become the nominee. But the commission was planning, as was the media, as was the Secret Service, as was, you know, the broader world, that there was a presumptive nominee, and there was a consensus who it was. And I think that there is that's a far cry from where John Kerry stood in Iowa or where Governor Crist might stand at some early stage in a primary. They're different concepts. But let me answer your flexibility question directly. Under that rationale, then the commission has already gone down the wrong path. I mean, I don't think it has, but it has already crossed this Rubicon. It's crossed it in two important respects. Number one, in the Montana MER, this commission unanimously, without a dissent, without a Democratic vote dissenting, without a Republican vote dissenting, for all of the media who thinks that the commission only acts on a partisan basis, it was 6-0. For all the media who think that that some of the commissioners are ideologically, you know, never want to regulate and others always want to regulate, it was 6-0 to reject the general counsel's view that you just articulated. So that Rubicon has been crossed. We are beyond the days of it is only for the actual nominee. Okay, that's number one. Number two, you have a big problem with the way in which the commission reads 441AD, which, as I said, is actually stricter. I mean, you can debate whether nominee means actual nominee. You can debate whether nominee means presumptive nominee, whether it means theoretical nominee. You can debate all of that. In connection with the general election is clearer to me than nominee. And this commission has sensibly, very sensibly, not applied that kind of strict test to the 441A, to the interpretation of in connection with the general election. And taking those two things together, it's not a big hop from where this commission was 6-0 in 1998 to where I'm suggesting it go now.
See, but I don't actually agree that it's not, you know, it's all the same, because there really was, you know, barring an act of God, you know, there was nothing else that could happen. And, you know, okay, I hear you. In this race, you know, we can all read the newspapers and, you know, we could probably predict with a fair degree of certainty who the nominee is. But the problem is that it leaves us with a very mushy standard. You know, it's like, okay, this one might seem easy, but the next one is going to be maybe a little bit more ambiguous. And maybe there's somebody who's got a little bit of a chance, but probably not a great chance. I think if the party wanted, for example, you know, there was a time in our nation's history when parties generally just chose their own nominee. The party bosses would get together, they'd choose the nominee. They adopted a different system, a system that requires elections. And if there is, you know, I don't know. I don't know how we say, you know, well, this guy's got serious competition, but this other guy has you know, only token opposition. You know, it seems to me a little bit, I don't know, patronizing for us to say, oh, that candidate, you know, we don't have to count that candidate who might think that he's a serious candidate.
I would offer two responses to that. The first is there's a part of where you began that makes me think you might actually vote in favor of my approach, because after all, this is an advisory opinion in this case. And if, in fact, you believe in this case, it's clear, then I would argue that I ought to get the advisory opinion that we sought in this case, which is the only thing that is currently before the commission. So that may be a way that you'd be comfortable adopting.
But what would the standard be?
Well, but it's an advisory opinion that is a shield against the Nevada Democratic Party being winding up here before Murr. That's what it is. It's a shield. It's just our effort to not have a Murr come before us. And if in this case we are, in fact, where you suggest you believe we are, then it strikes me that we ought to get the advisory opinion that we requested, and we shouldn't have to wait 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever it would be. The second thing, though, Commissioner Weintraub, is that candidly, your argument in some sense proves too much for this commission, because in fact, in the debate context, this commission sanctions exactly the kind of judgments that you are now saying you can't make, because every candidate who files a MRR that comes before this commission, who says I was excluded from the debates, thinks, oh, I had a chance, I could have done it. And this commission has said, you know what, no, we're going to let the sponsors apply some real world practical criteria.
Right, but we have regulations. I mean, if we were in a rulemaking context, I think you're right, we could absolutely set up a rule that said, you know, for these purposes, we could adopt the rule that you suggested earlier. You know, if you have less than 10% support in the polls, then it's not, if none of your opponents have more than 10% support in the polls, then we're going to assume that you are the presumptive, ostensible, whatever you want to call it, nominee, and you get this advantage. But that's I don't think we can do that in an AO. I think that's a rulemaking.
But Commissioner Weintraub, in some sense, you're putting my client in an impossible position, because on the one hand, you yourself have said on these facts, there is no question about what the outcome is, and therefore, presumably.
Well, I don't know if I said there's no question. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, well, but then therefore, in this case, under that theory, we should get our advisory opinion. The answer should be yes. Your response to that seems to be, yes, but what about the next case? Well, when I then want to say, well, hear about the next case, you say, well, but then you want a rulemaking. So I'll take it either way. I'll either say, let's set the rule going forward for all, at which point I point to the fact that in the debate context, the commission allows real-world consequences to be real-world to be taken into account. Or I'll take the case by case, and you can just say the Nevada Democratic Party, we the FEC are here to announce, don't file a complaint against the Nevada Democratic Party for what they said they wanted to do, because that's what they get for asking for an advisory opinion. And they don't get anything more than that. And nobody else gets more than that. That's what they get. It can't be, though, that I can't have that, because it would create a mushy standard. And yet when I want to set a not mushy standard, you tell me that I want a rulemaking.
Well, except that when we write an AO, it's based on law. It's not based on my gut reaction. I don't issue AOs based on, right, you know, in my gut, I believe you're right, but I need a legal standard. And then I go back to the legal standard and it says nominee. And, you know, at a certain point, it'll be for sure that he's going to be, you know, barring acts of God, a nominee. But
the commission's already 6-0 said it doesn't. The commission has already said we're not interpreting nominee to mean nominee. It's already done that.
But that was in a case where there was. This isn't on all fours with the Baucus facts in that Murr. If it was, then you'd probably get your AO.
I agree with you. What I know is that the Baucus facts are not he was the nominee. It was something before that.
Right.
So now the only question is how far before that, right? I mean that. But you keep coming back and saying, but it can't. But it has to be the nominee. Well, the Baucus Murr already said that isn't true. So we know it doesn't have to be the nominee. It's just how early in the process
right.
It can be.
And under either, you know, I mean, either of these drafts or, you know, anything that we've been discussing here, which of course you're not privy to. You know, nobody is suggesting that the commission should now adopt a rigid definition that says, no, you got to wait until the primary is actually held. So you're right. We have already demonstrated some flexibility. That doesn't mean that we have to demonstrate ultimate flexibility.
That's right. But it also doesn't mean that you're statutorily constrained from doing so. My point is that if your argument is, we'd love to demonstrate flexibility, but we can't because it says nominee and that means nominee, then you have essentially adopted the General Counsel's Office report from 1998, which was rejected 6-0. That was their position. It was a perfectly sensible position. It was wrong. I think it was wrong-minded. And it was sensibly defeated. So the commission already said, we don't mean in a Scalia-like way that nominee just means nominee, okay? And we have no flexibility, we're not going beyond that. The commission is now simply deciding whether the right place of flexibility is here or is here. But you already decided there's flexibility. And I would, you know, say the same thing to you that I started by saying to Commissioner McGann. It is an irony. We are about to have rulemakings about coordination and soft money. We have just had an enormous amount of discussion and national anxiety around corporate and soft money spending swamping out parties. And I am before you today asking for volunteers to be able to be funded to distribute candidate materials on behalf of someone who you, or not even one person, on behalf of candidates who you seem to feel, even you believe, are clearly going to be the nominee. And it just seems to me that it is an odd place for the commission to decide, let's draw the line short here, right? If I would think the commission in this environment would say, let's promote volunteer activity. Let's promote hard money activity. Let's promote strong state parties using federal money to promote federal candidates.
And I think that's a good policy argument that a lot of people have made, and it is the policy argument for abolishing the coordinated expenditure limits, which every time it comes up in the Senate doesn't happen. Frankly, it's your clients who stop it. And you know, so that's kind of a problem also, because it's fine to say on a policy basis, everybody agrees that they're, you know, as long as you're using hard money and as long as you're using volunteers, this is what we ought to be promoting, and everybody thinks this is a great idea. But in fact, what we're talking about is how broadly we're going to construe an exemption to a limit. If the limit weren't there in the first place, we wouldn't have to have right. this discussion, right? You know, then it would be, if the rule was you can spend unlimited hard money for anything you want to do, then great. But that's actually not the law either.
Right. And I think that the question of what Congress does is up to Congress. I mean, Congress will decide they want to change the law, they don't want to change the law. That's their business. The commission has operated at its best where it has found practical ways to allow parties and candidates to run elections. It has operated at its worst where it has found that there are no practical ways for them to run elections. And it has found itself being sued. And I'm not, and again, I don't say this with respect to this case, because there's no threat to sue here. Okay. I want to just take that off the table. We're not suing. But it finds itself getting sued when it simply does not want to allow there to be practical ways for candidates and parties, in this case, to fund volunteers. I mean, to fund volunteer exempt activity. It's like, you know, apple pie. You know, in the campaign finance world, I mean, you know, what could be better than state parties using volunteers to distribute campaign materials? And I think that you are in a situation where you have the statutory and the constitutional authority to interpret a statute. You can interpret it a little bit more strictly, a little bit more conservatively. You have that discretion. So we are in a policy area. It's why you all were appointed by the President of the United States, confirmed by the U.S. Senate. You're here to exercise your policy judgment on a statute that can be read a little bit this way or a little bit that way. There's legislative history that reads one way, there's language reads another, there's precedent that reads one way, there's AOs that read another way. You have the discretion to go one way or the other. And so my urge to you about policy is not that you should try and repeal 441AD, that's not within your authority to do. But within the confines of what the commission can do, you have a choice. You have a choice between a narrow tact or a choice between a broader tact. And, you know, ultimately, that's why, because these things are uncertain, that's why lawyers like me submit questions for you all to decide. But I think that there's no good policy reason not to take the broader approach.
Any further questions or comments? Commissioner Bowerly, Vice Chair Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I completely agree with you. We have choices to make between broader and narrower, and I agree that we have crossed the Rubicon, of thinking about nominee and not post-election, which if you look at the dictionary definition, means to be nominated, which suggests there's been some formal process like an election. But I agree with my colleagues who've noted that the statute says nominee, not candidate, which is a much broader category of people. And so I come back to your assertion that what we should allow is the party to spend this funds on presumptive nominees who appeared assured of winning the nomination or whose nominations are a foregone conclusion. And so I think the question for me is, how do we know when someone is appeared assured of winning the nomination or whose nominations are a foregone conclusion? And I take your point from the comment that I would agree that Mickey Mouse could never be assured of whose nomination is a foregone conclusion, because I assume even in Nevada, Mickey Mouse is not allowed to be a candidate. But I do I still can't get to how do we know that someone is assured of winning a nomination or whose nomination is a foregone conclusion without something like a filing date closing with respect to a nomination. I think that, and while not in a primary context, there's a number of cases, and while I agree we shouldn't make rules for the outliers, and that's not what you're asking, but I do think you're asking us to identify how to know, how a party could know, how you can know, and how, because AOs can be relied on people in other parties in similar situations, and I think my colleague said that AOs set, some markings, so we have to be aware of what we're doing and be conscious of that. I come from a place where everyone thought it was a publicity stunt when Jesse Ventura ran for governor. Turns out, if that was his intent at the start, I don't know, but he got elected, and a lot of people in Minnesota said he was a fine governor. So, my challenge in this is, and that's why I come back to the filing date as one way we can be assured of knowing whose nominations are a foregone conclusion or appeared assured of winning the nomination, and without something like a filing date, I have trouble throwing open the door to say, just because the party prefers it. And I appreciate that there are costs to that party if they guess wrong. But you've identified a test for us, and I think we have to identify the facts in which we can, at least I could be comfortable saying, when does someone appear to be assured of winning the nomination? And that's and I think that the first draft that went public, 10-11, is the one that makes me most comfortable with this standard. And while it may be possible to go further, I think we have to do that in a responsible way as well.
Well, if I can respond to am I allowed to respond or no?
I think we originally set this process up for questions.
I apologize. I thought it was a question. I didn't realize.
My question to you is, okay, then,
if there is no question,
because how do we know whose nominations are a foregone conclusion without some hard piece of process versus just the preference of a party, which I think we've talked about both, right? We've talked about sort of preferential candidates, but then we've also talked about this idea of presumptive nominees. And I thought we were in the presumptive nominee category, which is, I think, what the Baucus premise was based on, that there was basically no one else could be the nominee. And how do we know when that person's nomination is a foregone conclusion? And if you have another way of knowing that, other than the party wants it to be so, because unless you're suggesting to me that parties can somehow determine the outcomes of, election day primaries, I don't know how they can be telling us that the nomination is a foregone conclusion other than by a filing deadline.
Well, a couple of things. First, the answer to how we know is that the parties know. I mean, the FEC needn't know. There actually isn't a reason why the federal government would need to know that. The question is whether the parties can spend their money and whether they know it. And what criteria a party would use to know that are the same criteria that parties use to know a lot of things about presumptive nominees. Then when the Republican convention built a stage next to your hometown, they put all of these big signs that said McCain. Now,
They could have been wrong, and it would have been embarrassing because they would have had someone else nominated with all these big McCain signs. And, you know, but they knew somehow. They figured out that it is very likely. It's possible he says no. It's possible the delegates come to town and say, you know what, we've changed our mind. It's possible a scandal befalls him. It's possible any number of things happen, and then, you know what, we look really bad because we guessed that it was going to be this guy, but we guessed wrong. But the fact is the parties have an idea. You mentioned primaries, and I hate to talk about this broader because I'm asking an advisory opinion on behalf of one state party, but what about caucus states? What if the party knows because they know who the caucus? What if it's a special like in the House has all the time where the central committee of a county or whatever?
It may moot out the primary if the convention nominates for the party.
Yeah.
That's what you're
thinking. What if the party central committee selects the nominee, and they know? I don't think that the commission needs to focus on what criteria the commission will use.
What about Louisiana? Not to jump in and ask questions, but just for fun.
What about Louisiana?
Discuss. I mean, that's a jungle deal.
Because Washington State and Louisiana. It's actually another good example of why I think you should read it sensibly, because otherwise you're going to say they can't do any exempt activities in Louisiana.
I know it's a good example, but maybe explain why it's a good example.
It's a good example because they run in an open process. All the candidates run on one ballot, rather than in party primaries, and then you're saying that they can't run exempt activities at all, because the party, even though in Louisiana the Democratic Party will say, this is our candidate, this is the person we support, and you've interpreted 441AD in a way to make that possible. Sorry, for exempt activities, you know, we're not going to let you as a party say that's who your nominee is.
Vice Chair, if you yield, I don't want to jump in the way, but in Nevada, is there any formal mechanism by the party rules? Whether internal or maybe you can't answer internal, but I'm not familiar with Democratic Party rules like I am Republican rules. I know the Republican National Committee has rules as to how they can play in primaries, and you need sign off by the committee woman, the chair. You know, NRCC had rules about if the delegation votes and they can play in a primary. DCCC, I think, probably had a similar rule, although I don't know the nuances because I've never seen the secret document. Has the Nevada Party gone through anything that would be under its party rules and say this is our nominee?
I think
that's where the vice chair is. There anything beyond the filing date that's tangible?
I don't know. The answer to your question is I don't know specifically whether I saw the draft, but it was late last night. I didn't have a chance to. I anticipated this question, but I didn't have a chance to find out the answer, whether they either have in their rules or have invoked in their rules anything. I guess I come back to the same place, though, which is that you should, I think, assume that the parties will operate in accordance with their rules. And if their rules prohibit them from doing something, then they won't do it. And if the rules permit them to do it, then they will. It strikes me, and I know you are only partially being facetious, but if in fact a party has confidential, we won't say secret, but confidential rules about how they operate, it is a daunting prospect to be told that the price of them doing this is that someone files a MIR, they then have to produce these rules, explain their internal processes, that then gets put on the public record when their MIR is concluded. I mean, it just, I suppose, I like A better than I like whatever not A is, but it seems to me that it suffers from a little bit of the same problem of, rather than just saying, okay, parties, if you have a candidate who you believe is a presumptive nominee in a court, and we're going to presume you're acting in accordance with your rules, okay? Unless there's some reason to the contrary for us to believe that you're not, we're going to assume that you're acting, you know, in conformity with your rules.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. Mr. Elias, you mentioned earlier that the FEC was talking to you when you were the then counsel to the Kerry campaign in treating your candidate as the presumptive nominee. And I'm just curious, what were the ramifications of that?
Well, it mostly dealt with matching funds.
Okay.
Public grant.
General fund.
The public grant. But, I mean, the commission staff worked diligently and hard, and to its credit, under a very tight timetable to turn around a lot of paperwork and a lot of money, both of which were appreciated, the second more than the first.
You're talking about the public, the general election money.
Yeah, and they did
They didn't give you anything until after you certified that he was that Senator Kerry was selected at his convention.
That is correct, okay. but they knew who the presumptive nominee was. And in fact, I think I even got a piece of paper saying you're the...
But they didn't say, here's the money, you know, don't spend it until he gets nominated.
That's right. They do that with 441AD, but not with the public grant. You're right. My point, though, is that for folks to say, we have no idea what a presumptive nominee is, until it's actually a foregone conclusion, there can be no knowing. Well,
But they're not going to give you the money. I mean, they might plan ahead, but they're not going to give you the money until it's certain. And having been the one that helped get President Bush on the ballot in 2004, the states wouldn't put him on the ballot until they had certifications from us for all 50 states. And I know you guys did the same thing, obviously, to get his name on the ballot. They didn't care about being presumptive. We had to do the roll at the convention, have a formal document, and send it to every state.
Correct. And if the commission were still in 1997, then the question of whether or not you need to be the actual nominee, whether you actually need to have the role, would be the question before you today.
But there was a point where, I'm not sure if this is, without getting into too much detail, there was a point where at least one major political party tried to get the money a little in advance. And they were told no, because under the Republican Party rules, there was an opportunity. There was no certainty until the actual roll was completed, and that was an issue, as you probably know.
Correct, and that's why I say if we were in 1997, then this commission pre-Baucus-Murr, we could be having a conversation about whether or not nominee means just means what it says until the roll is called. But the commission's already crossed that bridge. You've already said you've already said, to use the analogy, we're going to give you the money before the convention. The question. In the exempt area,
right.
not in the public financing. You've already crossed that with exempt activity. You've already said, we're going to let you start spending early.
Okay.
So now the question is, what does it mean for the party to know that it's the nominee? Is it that no one else is on the ballot, or can they know it before then? And I would argue that they obviously have argued that they know it beforehand. In fact, I guess I would restate it differently. I'm not arguing they know it beforehand. They do know it beforehand. They do. I could pull up nrsc.org right now, and I could look on their website, and they know who their nominees are in a lot of places. Some places they don't. Some places they have no idea who their nominee is. In other places, they know who their nominee is. I will tell you right now, Congressman Boehner is the nominee. I don't know anything about, I couldn't tell you anything about the district, but he's a nominee.
Which is ironic, because when he first got elected, he the presumptive nominee was Buzz Lukens.
Okay.
And we know what happened there. So, and then John jumped in last minute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob Ney was a presumptive nominee up until
mm-hmm.
October.
It's true.
You know, some of these Ohio districts, the presumptive nominees aren't really the presumptive nominee.
And those folks can be the only people on the ballot. They can be the only people on the ballot and drop out. So unless you're going to go back and set the clock back 20 years, or at least 10 years, more than 10 years, 15 years, then you're going to get that. You're going to get it. You're going to get that. That is a reality. There are going to be some number of situations where 441AD gets spent and the candidate doesn't win or drops out. There are going to be some situations under either of these two drafts, under either draft, where a candidate qualifies as the nominee for legal purposes and then winds up not being the general election candidate. That's just a reality. So I think we can either say that's going to happen, not often, and the federal government ought to be the one who draws this line. Or that's going to happen, not frequently, and we're going to let the parties sort it out for themselves, because by and large, they know.
I've got just one question, and that's with regard how the draft that you responded to, the first draft that came out, how it relates to the Montana Dems-Murr. When I read the draft, I don't see this as a retreat from the Montana Dems-Murr. Obviously, that statement of reasons, as you rightly point out, a 6-0 state. statement of reasons, which did build in a little more flexibility on what the definition of nominee was going to be. And they rely heavily on that there could be no other Democratic candidate for this office, because under state law, there was just no, the field of candidates had been closed because of the operation of state law. And the way I read the draft, the first draft that we had, it's that principle by which the conclusion is reached in that draft. So I don't view this as a retreat. And I was wondering, and from the comments that you submitted, and also the very useful comments you've provided here, you're not, I don't hear you saying that we're basically turning back the clock, but that we should use that as a stepping stone or a foundation to maybe go a little bit further. Is that an accurate statement?
I would say that it is something in between. I think that the fact that the statement of reasons, I would say that the statement of reasons noted the fact that the ballot had closed. I don't know that that was dispositive in that MER. My recollection of that MER, real time going back, is a little bit fuzzy, but it was certainly a relevant fact. But that also wasn't you could have asked the day before the ballot closed, the day after the ballot closed, or 3 months before the ballot closed, and anyone could have told you who the nominee of the Democratic Party was going to be in that race. It is certainly noted, and I don't want to, in that sense, suggest that you're retreating in a literal sense. Mm-hmm. But I also wouldn't say, I'm not sure how central that was as a determinative fact.
Because as I was reading through it, it seemed to be a fairly central fact in the paragraph that really addresses this. It talks about how there could be no other Democratic candidate for this office while Montana allows write-in candidates. These candidates must file declarations of intent, and it mentions that the brochures at issue, it was 5 days prior to the Montana primary election that they were distributed, and that no declaration of intent had been filed by anybody else. And then thus, as both a matter of fact and as a matter of state law, Mr. Bach was the MDP's presumptive nominee. And then in that same paragraph, there's a footnote that's dropped that also talks about how Senator Baucus was the only candidate under Montana law who could receive the Democratic nomination. So it seems like it was more than, as I read it, it seems more than just a note, like that's a persuasive fact. It appears that statement based their expansion of the notion of nominee quite heavily on the fact that under state law, there couldn't be anybody else. And that appears to be the same line that we're drawing here, which, again, I think has the virtue, and this has been brought up, I think, by pretty much everybody up here, is that it may not be perfect, but it is a bright line objective test to determine whether or not someone has if the ballot is closed, as it was in the Montana case and as it would be here in Nevada after March 12th. It is a bright line, and it does provide greater flexibility than saying you have to receive the actual nomination before you can avail yourself of the volunteer materials exception.
I appreciate all of the time and courtesies you've shown me, so I don't want to wear out my welcome, and I certainly don't want to do it by repeating myself. I will say that I think that this bright line you all are setting up or may set up is going to be a trap. It's not going to be a bright line. It's not going to hold. You're going to retreat from it. You're going to retreat from it on the first MER. The first time a complaint gets filed because there was a write-in capability that was different. They could have lost in a write-in, the MER will say. That'll go. It may go 4-2. It may go 6-0. It may go 3-3 in a deadlock. But that'll no longer be the bright line rule. The next time there's a MER where there's a LaRouche candidate, who no one paid any attention to, never filed with the FEC, didn't even file a statement of candidacy with the FEC because he didn't raise to spend $5,000, but got on the ballot and no one caught it, you'll heckler v. Cheney it, and that'll be gone. So the fact is there doesn't have to be, the commission can draw the line wherever it wants, but this is not that bright a line. This is going to be a trap for all of these state parties and these state campaign and these county parties, and you will wind up whittling this back until we wind up in some place that is much muddier and murkier than what I'm proposing now. Because I predict this commission or different composition is gonna the candidate who didn't file a committee with the FEC, the candidate who was just a write-in possibility, is going to wind up being the exceptions to these rules, and it's going to be the first series of exceptions, and you're going to wind up back in the muddy middle.
So that's just my prediction.
And I think that I can't look into the future and know exactly what's going to happen. But you may be right and may be wrong. But there is a slightly different role between trying to ascertain what the standard is versus how we're going to enforce that standard, just based on a whole variety of, as you mentioned, under Heckler v. Cheney, we have to make all sorts of decisions about how egregious a violation, how much money was at stake. There are a whole and it's a slightly different role in the enforcement context. And I know that many say that, then please tell me in advance so I can know what's going to be enforced and what's not.
But that's why we're here.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, that's what the advisory opinion process is.
Right.
So I guess I'd amend my request, tell me about write-ins now. I don't know if they're write-in allowed in Nevada, but I guess I should just ask.
You said they aren't.
Okay, then that's fair enough. Then there are no write-ins, so.
We checked.
Okay, good.
It's in the request.
What if someone files and doesn't file with the FEC? Is that good enough? If they don't have a committee, but they file to get on the ballot. Is that good enough? I mean, because telling me that you'll Heckler Cheney it down the road means my clients have to go through the bad press and the legal expenses, which is the reason why you come to the FEC to get an advisory opinion.
Commissioner Wondrow.
Just a couple of comments, not questions, comments. We all know that's wherever we draw the line, there will be another case that's a little bit further down the line, and then we'll have to decide that. And that's true whether we do exactly what you want or whether we do either of these drafts or some other thing that we make up at the table. That's why we have discretion in enforcement. And the other comment that I wanted to make is, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about presidential conventions and, given the way we elect nominate presidents in the modern era, at a certain point, it becomes a mathematical certainty. You know, yes, there's a theoretical possibility that, the electors won't vote the way the voters told them to, but that's when you become the presumptive nominee in the presidential context is when people start adding up the states that you've won and they say, oh, you're over the top where nobody can catch up, and we have to wait till the end of the process to write the check, but we know. And it seems to me that that's a little bit different from what we're grappling with today.
Well, this is, I think, been a very, I mean, of the advisory opinion since we've had the hearing process, I think this has been one of the most interesting and enlivening. I think the comments and questions from my colleagues and also Mr. Elias, all of the observations, both in your written and your presentation, I think have been enormously enlightening on both this matter and also give us a lot of food for thought for a lot of things relating to this issue. I think we're now at the point where we have to start putting rubber to the road and figuring out where the votes lie and where we are on the various drafts. So, Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think the time is now to wrap up. My sense is that there is consensus for the filing deadline. After the filing deadline, you can do volunteer mail. I don't think that there's enough support to go prior to that date. I'm inclined to go prior to that date, but I'm still floating in a zone that I'm not sure that there's solid ground under me. The party had done something and said this is our nominee under its rules, then you kind of guessed that the second draft was my penmanship. So I can concur certainly with the first blue draft with a couple thoughts. There's some language in that draft, late in the draft, I think it's on page 5, that talks about you can't make payments for the materials prior to the date. I don't think that's really the rule. I think if we're going to go with green lighting them to do volunteer mail once the ballot access period closes, they ought to be able to drop the mail right away. Chairman Peterson made this joke coming in the door. He said it's kind of like when the football teams play the Super Bowl. Both teams print up the hats saying they're Super Bowl champions, just in case. But the current draft makes it sound like you can't make the hats. You have to wait for the date before you start spending money. I think, I'm not going to speak for my colleagues, but my sense is that we should be able to at least let you do the grant, do the mechanics of moving money to the postal account, printing the mail, and all that prior to, if you are assured. And this gets at your policy concern that if you guess wrong, well, you've wasted all that money and you've printed a bunch of mail for a guy who's not going to be your nominee. You may have already printed the mail. Who knows? But it seems to me that any payments, it doesn't really matter when you pay for the stuff, as long as it's within a commercially reasonable time and all that. It's when you drop the mail that matters. And if the consensus is the ballot date, the ballot access date, then you should be able to drop the mail right away. So if we can soften that language to make that clear, I can at least certainly support the March 12th. I might be inclined to go farther, but my sense is that we just don't have consensus on that point, because, well, I'm not sure if we go beyond that date where we're going. And you know, I can say it out loud. If I'm not sure where it goes, that's really soft ground. Okay. I mean, it's a state party case. I mean, we all can say it, right? The pink elephant in the corner. I mean, it's you didn't get me. And if you don't get me, it's just, I got to tell you. Yeah, if you had the party rules, maybe. But see, we all know it to be true. But so I think that's where we are, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to speak for everyone else, but that's just reading the tea leaves. I think that's I hope that's where we are. So at least you can do volunteer activity before the actual primary happens months from now. Unfortunately, my sense is you're not going to get a green light to do it prior to the ballot closing.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand your concern about the language on page 5 that focuses on payments, and I don't think that is where, while I agree that's how the language could be read, I don't think that was the intention, that it is the activity, that issue, not the payment. So anticipating that we might be able to coalesce around this draft. We have shared some language with our colleagues that we just handed to General Counsel. I'll read it so everyone understands it. This is on the draft that was the first one that went out the door. On page 5, starting at line 11, there's a sentence that starts by contrast at the end of line 11. We would delete the following sentences to the end of the page and replace it to make clear that it is the activity at issue, not the payments. So it would say, by contrast, payments made by the state party from materials that are used in connection with volunteer activities on behalf of candidates will not qualify for the volunteer materials exemption if those activities take place before March 12, 2010. The exemption will also not apply to payments from materials used in connection with the volunteer activities on behalf of candidates in the primary election who have an opponent in the election. To clarify that it is the activities at issue rather than the payment. And I think that's a good, important clarification, because I don't think that was ever the intent, but I think you're right, it can be read that way. So if it's amenable, we would propose that as an amendment to draft to the document that's noted as 10-11.
Commissioner McGann.
Appreciate the effort to present alternative language, and I think it's close. The second sentence, for me, puts too fine a point on it, really, for the points that Mr. Elias raised. When we get into a MER, there may be times where we could find that there was token opposition, but, well, maybe the party didn't even realize there was token opposition. So to actually affirmatively vote for the proposition that the exemption will not apply without any sort of ability for flexibility down the road, perhaps, to payments for materials used in connection with volunteer activities on behalf of the candidates in the primary election who have an opponent in that election, I'm not sure we need to address that here today and cabin this in. And if we could maybe split the difference and not include that sentence, I can join in the first sentence, although I'm not crazy about the first sentence. It at least accomplishes the goal of allowing them to print the materials and get the materials ready to go. But it does require, I presume, the volunteer activity to occur after the nomination period closes. So at least they have an AO that then gives them protection. But the second sentence, I think, for me, goes a little too far. I just don't think we need to do it here today. I think it's clear that that several think that that is true, I would rather leave that fight for another day. Not that it would be a fight. I think it'd be more of a civil discussion, because this has actually been one of our best discussions on the more we get into the details of election law, the easier it is to discuss.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I guess my concern about that is, I mean, that was a rewrite of the second half of the sentence that we replaced, and we put it in its own sentence because, frankly, it was getting to be a really long sentence, and it was complicated. And as I thought about this, I thought, well, you know, the key is the opponent part. It's not the before or after March 12th part. It's does he have an opponent? And I guess my concern about our leaving that sentence out is that we're not actually answering the question. That, I mean, you know, I think he needs to know the answer to that question. That's part of why he's here. So, I mean, you know, I guess we could only answer part of the question, but I think that's what we would be doing, is just not answering part of the question.
Commissioner McGann.
I still think we'd be answering the question. What we're not doing is giving him the advisory opinion protection, and I think Mr. Elias will come away from here realizing that if they do volunteer mail before March 12th, they're going to have a problem on the enforcement side, not to prejudge. But my sense is there will be some interest there. But I'm not so sure we need to, in an AO, state the answer to the question in the negative in such a way. Particularly because if you read the sentence, it talks about activities on behalf of candidates in the primary election. Well, volunteer mail is not on behalf of the candidate in the primary election. It's behalf of the party's nominee, or if it's coordinated, it's in connection with the general election. And whether we go around the ring as to which is more permissive or which is more restrictive, volunteer activities are never going to be on behalf of the primary election. It's going to be on behalf of the nominee. So it seems to me that sentence muddies the waters more than it needs to. And I think the first sentence accomplishes the job of capturing the consensus of the commission that you're okay March 12th and beyond, or I'm not sure if March 12th is the filing day or not, but whenever filing closes, I assume, and after you're fine, but before you can't drop the mail. And I think the first sentence accomplishes that, which is the question that he's asking.
I guess I think that is the sentence is the logical consequence of the previous sentences in that paragraph. And if we were to decide to take that sentence out, I still believe that Mr. Elias would be on thin ice if he didn't understand that to be the logical consequence of the earlier sentences. I just don't... I don't know how you don't get to that place.
It's not really Mr. Elias and his client I'm worried about. It's if another state party wishes to use this AO for protection, but for whatever reason there is a write-in in that state or there is something, and whether or not that's a material distinction or not is not something we can decide here today. But if we put that sentence in, we are deciding, I think, other cases. Maybe we don't want to offer AO protection to those other state parties. I'm inclined to at least give it a little bit of breathing room, given that we have 50 different states with 50 different state laws, and see someone in another state may come in, another client of Mr. Elias's may come in 3 months with a similar issue but a different state law. And whether or not there's really a primary opponent or not, maybe his arguments he made here today will, in another context, in another state, on another backdrop, be more persuasive to more of us than they were today. And that my point is it seems like we are carving a line that we don't need to carve by including that second sentence.
But that would be another AO. I mean, you know, in another context, in another state with different state laws, they couldn't rely on this AO anyway, because they'd be in another context in another state with a different state law.
Right, but in this AO, then you're assuming a fact not before us because it talks about candidates in the plural. We don't have candidates in the plural, correct?
Correct.
Right. And candidates who have an opponent in the primary election, we don't have that today. We, I mean, maybe there's going to be a token, you know, filing just to throw the state party off its game, but chances are no. So it seems to me that we are getting into answering factual issues that are not before us because we got candidates and opponents, and we don't have that here.
I think you're right. As you spoke, I realized that was a drafting error. It should say on behalf of a candidate who has, you know, any opponents, I suppose. It's the way it would have to be collected.
So maybe what we're trying to say then, maybe what we're trying to say is in the event an opponent appears between now and then no volunteer mail for you.
Until you beat him, I guess.
Right. Okay. So in other words, really what the sentence is trying to say is in the event that an opponent appears and you have a contested primary and somehow this changes the facts between now and March 12th, this is not a green light to do volunteer mail if you actually have a contested primary.
That is
a question before us. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure that's what this sentence says, but...
I apologize. But it was now, drafted late at night.
No, I understand. I appreciate the effort because I was having trouble. I mean, I couldn't do any better, so I appreciate it. But maybe we can spend a minute trying to figure out how to make it say what we're trying to make it say, so it doesn't take on a life of its own down the road in unrelated matters.
Why don't we take about a 5-minute recess just to work on that. We're back in session, and I would note that I think we actually did keep this 5-minute recess to 5 minutes, which is, if nothing else, breaking new ground there.
Mr. Chairman, you're a marvel.
I think we've reached consensus on the amendment that Commissioner Weintraub has proposed.
Commissioner Bowerly proposed it, but it's kind of a joint project.
It's kind of, yeah. Well, many authors of this one. I think that we've reached some agreement on keeping the first sentence of that and striking the second sentence and modifying the draft in that manner. So, does council have the?
I believe they
the
do.
Copy? So basically, the sentence saying the exemption will also not, and then everything following from that would be stricken. We would just include the first sentence in the amendment. Right. Commissioner Weintraub.
If you'll permit me, I think just for total clarity, I hope, let me try restating the now amended motion. Okay, how about that? I move that we adopt agenda document number 10-11. Not 10-11A, but 10-11, with the following amendment, that on page 5, we delete the sentence that starts on line 11 with the phrase by contrast and runs to the word election on line 16, and we substitute the sentence by contrast payments made by the state party, comma, for materials that are used in connection with volunteer activities on behalf of candidates, comma, will not qualify for the volunteer materials exemption if those activities take place before March 12th, 2010, period. And that we further authorize council to make any technical and conforming changes.
Does everyone understand the motion?
Yes, I understand the motion.
Okay.
Yes.
If everyone understands the motion, let's call the votes. Everyone in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No opposition. So the motion passes 5-0. And Mr. Elias, thanks again. I mean, this has both been enlightening and enlivening, and you've given us, like I said, a lot of food for thought for this and many other things as well. So thank you again.
And if I can just express my appreciation to the commission and to the commissioners for the opportunity to address questions and offer views and
The addition of this to the AO process, I think, is welcome, and I think all of you are to be congratulated. I know oftentimes that everyone focuses on the really big projects the FEC does on rulemakings, but candidly, it is very often the improvements to the process itself, like things like this, that make the biggest difference to the regulated community. And I think all of you are to be thanked for it.
All right, thank you, Mr. Elias, and we'll look forward to the next request that that provides as much thought and entertainment as this one did. So thank you again. All right. Next matter on the agenda is draft notice of proposed rulemaking for standards of conduct, agenda document number 1010. We will be having a presentation. From Tony Buckley, Ethan Carrier, and Bob Knopp from the Office of General Counsel. And Commissioner Walther has rejoined us. Let the record show. Mr. Buckley, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 1010 is a draft notice of proposed rulemaking regarding standards of conduct for commissioners and commission employees. The NPRM was drafted, and this rulemaking is being conducted with the concurrence of the Office of Government Ethics. The NPRM explains and seeks comments on proposed rules to update the Commission's standards of conduct at 11 CFR Part 7, as well as new rules which supplement the Office of Government Ethics Standards of Ethical Conduct at 5 CFR Chapter 37. Procedurally, once the NPRM is signed by the chairman, it will be forwarded to OGE for the signature of their director, after which it will be forwarded to the Federal Register for publication. A 30-day comment period will follow publication in the Federal Register. I will be happy to address any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Any questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Not so much questions as comments.
Comments.
I cannot resist commenting on this one. We started this rulemaking in 2003 when I, shortly after I joined the commission and I became chair and was on the regs committee, and we were waiting for the McConnell decision to come down. Mr. Buckley, I think maybe you've been working on this as long as I have. Close. Certainly Ms. Smith has. We were waiting for the McConnell decision to come down, and Rosie gave us in regs committee a list of all the pending regs projects. We always have a long list of things that we keep meaning to get to, and somewhere buried on the list was this: conform our ethics rules to OGE's ethics rules. It's really sort of a housekeeping matter because we've always complied with the OGE rules, but on paper our rules didn't match up against theirs. And I said, well, we ought to fix that. And, you know, as a former ethics person, I said, I'd really like to get that done. So we started it in 2003, and I naively thought we could get it done in a couple of months while we were waiting for the McConnell decision to come down. But it's complicated to do something in conjunction with another agency. Everybody's got their own priorities, and we got busy with a number of other rulemakings in the interim. So, you know, our schedule and OGE's schedule never seemed to be in sync, and it went back and forth, and it went on and on. And here we are in 2010, and miraculously, I'm still here to, I thought I was never going to see the day, but it turns out that I actually am still here, and I would be delighted to move approval of this draft and finally get this to a place where I anticipate that this one will go relatively smoothly and that we'll actually be able to adopt these rules in a fairly expeditious fashion. So I want to thank all of the staff who have worked so patiently on this project over the years, and I also want to thank Ethan Carrier, our lead ethics guy, who came to this process a little bit late but has been very helpful, and to congratulate him because that rat, he's going to leave us for 6 months. He's been selected for a detail to the White House Counsel's office, something he didn't even apply for but was recommended for based on his well-known expertise as a government ethics lawyer, and we will miss him, and you better come back. And while I'm on the subject of congratulating ethics-related staff in the building, let me also congratulate, although he's not sitting in the room today, John Hatfield, who's just been nominated to be IG at another agency. He's our deputy IG here, and he's just been nominated to be IG at another agency, and we're proud of all the great staff who are recognized throughout the government for their expertise. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to preclude anybody else from talking about this, but I would be happy at the appropriate time to make a motion.
Is there any further discussion on the NPRM? I think that the field is clear for you to make the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that case, I delightedly move approval of agenda document number 1010 and direct staff to send it on its way so that it can be signed by all the appropriate people and published in the Federal Register and to make technical and conforming amendments if required.
All right, thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
The motion passes 6-0, and let me also extend my congratulations to Ethan. He puts on one of the best ethics training seminars that anybody could ever hope to be part of. You're definitely going to be missed during the 6 months, but like Commissioner Weintraub said, we'll look forward to your triumphant return, more ethical than ever, when we see you back in September. But, best of luck as you take on this new responsibility, and it's a tremendous credit to you as a person. And as a scholar and an attorney that you were chosen for this, so best of luck in this venture over the next 6 months. All right. Well, Mr. Palmer, do we have any management or administrative matters that needed to be addressed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have no additional items at this time.
With that, meeting is adjourned.